So I'd like to welcome all of you here this afternoon and begin with a general talk on Buddhist practice and try to make it as practical and useful to your daily life as I can. Briefly, for those of you who are relatively unfamiliar with Buddhist teachings, just a very quick kind of overview and to make a sort of comparison with the religious traditions that we are familiar with in the Western world. In that these days, I think it's noticeable that the word faith is being used more and more as a synonym for religion. So these days we talk about faith communities and the Christian faith and the Islamic faith and so on. And I think this points to the fact that in the West particularly, the general understanding is that religions are defined by faith. Faith is the primary or the cardinal virtue, and that religions are, say, first and foremost belief systems. Now, that is probably true of what we call the Abrahamic religions that grew up in the Middle East, but it's not really applicable to the religions that grew up in India, in particular Buddhism. So I like to characterize Buddhism not as a belief system religion, but as an education system religion. So it's a very different paradigm for what a religion is, what religious teachings are for, how we relate to a religion, and how we practice the religion. So in Buddhism, the human situation, our predicament, the challenges that we face in this present lifetime form the main focus. And the confidence or the faith that Buddhists do have is in the human ability to abandon suffering and its causes and to realize true peace, understanding, liberation through one's own the capacity that is inherent in the human condition. So that being the case, the Buddhist teachings are very much concerned with how we conduct ourselves in this present world, say how we relate to the people around us, the society we live in, how we use our minds, and the education, the training of conduct, of emotion, of thought, of our vision of life is the essence of the Buddhist religion. So the Buddha starts off with our basic situation as human beings, and the thesis or the proposition is that our lives are to one extent or another unsatisfactory, that the forms of happiness that we experience are limited. And that we inevitably face many difficulties and frustrations in our lives. And the difficulties, the frustrations, the pain in our lives can be divided into two kinds. There are those kinds of pain and difficulty which are inevitable, given the fact that we're born, we get old, we get sick, and we die. And there is a second kind of unsatisfactoriness of suffering, which is not inevitable, and which we can do something about. And it's this second kind of suffering which we are very interested in dealing with and overcoming in our life. Now, this education, as I was saying, has to cover both the inner and the outer world. So the representations of Buddhism, which you can come across sometimes in books as being sort of an inward-looking, life-denying kind of pessimistic teaching, are not really very accurate. And that the idea that meditate and go into a peaceful state and then you don't have to worry about the state of the world is a Buddhist response to the human condition, is definitely not to be found anywhere in the Buddhist texts. So our strategy has to be one in which there is a balance and a harmony between the way that we live our lives in the world and the way that we train and educate our inner selves. And the Theravada teachings, that is to say the teachings of the particular school of Buddhism that we find in Thailand, is one that puts great emphasis on the organic or to use a modern word, holistic nature of this education. I think that we often tend to be very kind of technique, information oriented when we pursue some topic, some interest, and encounter difficulties. Often we will tend to assume that we lack the information. There must be a technique, a trick, some shortcut, some particular way that we can deal with this. And this often applies to meditation practice, in which people try to meditate and then they find that it's very difficult and that their minds are very confused and agitated and incredibly frustrating trying to bring the mind into the present moment. And so a common response to this is to assume that there must be some better meditation technique, there must be some information, some sort of magic bullet, some way of dealing with this. When in fact the mental agitation and confusion that appears in meditation may well be a sign, or may be telling you that your life's out of balance. It's not because you're not doing it right or you're not following the instructions, but that your daily life is being conducted in such a way that it militates against any inner peace. So the fact that you find meditation very difficult is already quite a useful thing to happen, and if it makes you re-examine the way you're living your life. So this is why a lot of emphasis is put on precepts and virtue, sila. So then, because this isn't a faith, a belief system, there's not any concept of a divinely mandated morality, and one in which there is a system of reward and punishment. But the Buddha proposes that quite simple principle, that there are certain ways of living together which are conducive to peace and happiness, and there are certain ways of living together which lead to pain and confusion. And that in the way of ordering our life in society, we can make use of a basic, very important human ability, and that is the ability to reflect on experience and the ability to determine that a particular course of action may well result in short-term pleasure, but will lead to long-term distress for oneself or for another. Therefore, even though we might want to do something, might enjoy it, we say, no, I won't do that. And that's such a, such a basic and normal part of life that we can easily overlook. What a wonderful ability that is, you know, the ability to say no, not out of fear, or not just because of social pressure, but out of understanding that behaving in that way is not in conformity with the ideals and with the goals that I wish to pursue in my life. So taking on precepts is the first step of practice, and it leads to harmony with the people we live with, whether it's in our family or at work or in the community and society at large. But most importantly, it leads to a sense of self-respect, self-esteem. So the voluntarily taking on certain boundaries for one's action and speech through seeing clearly the value of those boundaries and the pain and suffering that often ensues from not having such boundaries, and then training oneself to be mindful, to recollect, to stay within those boundaries, gives rise to this sense of confidence that you're not just doing this because you've been told to, or you think it's required of you, but there's this general sense of inner acquiescence and interest and commitment. And that's where the sense of self-respect comes, because it's something that's coming from you because you want to do it, and the ability that you know that you can, even if you're in situations where you might be tempted or encouraged to step outside those boundaries. You know that you can, with tact, with restraint, and gently, firmly stay within those boundaries, that the sense of guilt and distress that comes through acting unwisely in our lives is much reduced. And this is really fundamental to spiritual practice. So if there's not that kind of effort put into our daily life, then the meditation taken out of context, it just becomes a kind of stress reduction exercise, which may have sort of certain undoubted benefits, but it doesn't really become part of this whole education process which the Buddha has given to us. So with the taking on these boundaries, as I say, it means that you have to hold them in your mind and recollect them, remember them in your daily life, often when quite a lot's going on. And that effort to remember those boundaries that you've voluntarily taken on and to find skillful means to be able to stay within them means that you have a mindfulness practice already in your daily life. So you're taking precepts as the objects of mindfulness. So there's a lot of talk about awareness and mindfulness and so on, but it's a psychological truth of human psychology is that you have to have be mindful of something. Mindfulness has to have an object. You can't just be because I'm mindful. You know, you always have to be mindful of something, and to the extent to which you're clear about what is the object of mindfulness is the extent to which your mindfulness will be sustained and will start to develop into some inner peace and clarity. So people say, well, how can you meditate in daily life when there's so much going on and so you have so many responsibilities? Thinking that meditation means sitting with your eyes closed in a quiet, peaceful place. But the real effort is to be mindful in a situation. So the question is more, in this situation, what shall I be mindful of? So if you're in a meeting, for instance, or you know, you have to contribute, you have to express opinions or discuss something, it's obviously not the time to sit quietly and watch your in-breath and your out-breath or to meditate on some kind of mantra. But this is a time to be mindful of speech. You know, can you stay within the boundaries of truth, only speak the truth, not to exaggerate, not to omit parts of the truth which are embarrassing? Can you be mindful of the right time and place, mindful of tone of voice, mindful of when is the appropriate time to listen rather than to speak, mindful of the kinds of feelings and emotions that arise as various people express their opinions and ideas? You say something and everyone praises it and says that's very wise and intelligent, good idea. How do you feel? Somebody rubbishes your idea and says it's stupid. How do you feel? So within that kind of situation, you have these various points of reference to be mindful of, beginning most basically with how you express yourself, how you speak, your body language, or the content of what you say. But also, once you have that as your basic kind of grounding, then you're able to be more refined and to be able to focus in on the various fleeting emotions and thoughts and perceptions of relating to praise and blame and to agreeing and disagreeing and liking this person and not liking that person and so on and so forth. So if there is this kind of effort during the day to be mindful, then if you have a regular meditation practice going, then it's not a major change in stride from your daily life, that there's been this flow of mindfulness, or at least an effort to be mindful throughout the day. And so turning to a more refined object of mindfulness, like the breath, for instance, is not a huge leap. So in other words, your ability to develop meditation technique successfully is going to be largely conditioned by what you're doing when you're not meditating. And similarly, your ability to be mindful and clear during your daily life is going to be affected and greatly enhanced if you are able to maintain a daily meditation period. So this is a kind of example of how the inner and the outer world have to reflect each other and be in harmony. Now, the as we develop more mindfulness, then we find an enhanced ability to be present to our experience. And this being in the present moment is a concept that I'm sure everyone will have heard, and I think it's an idea and a practice which again can be easily misunderstood, in that the Buddha is not recommending that we shut off all thoughts of the past and the future. One, it would be, except in very deep states of meditation, that's not possible anyway. But secondly, in our daily life, of course, we need to be able to draw on past experience to be able to deal with the various challenges in our daily life. And we also need to be making plans for the future. But what we notice is that we spend a lot of unnecessary time with past events and future events, not merely drawing on the lessons of the past in order to assist us in our present responsibilities and duties, but we often can be going over and over and over something somebody said or something done, sometimes weeks or months ago, and really upsetting ourselves again and again. Or else, when we experience some discomfort or boredom, rather than facing up to a present unpleasantness and looking into it and seeing just what's going on, then what we tend to do is just to try to jump out of that and escape from that into some pleasant experience. If we can't escape physically, then the obvious thing to do is to bring up some pleasant memory or an anticipation of the future. So we use memories of the past and thoughts of the future as a way of escaping from the present reality. And in certain circumstances, it's probably very good thing that we can do that. But on the path of this education, we're learning to developing the mental strength and resilience to face up to present experience and learn from it and let go of the causes of the suffering, rather than turning our back on it and trying to find some other thought, feeling, emotion to take our mind away from it. So this is the reason why developing mindfulness, developing that ability to be in the present moment, is not like the end of the practice, but it's the beginning of the practice, if you like, because we can start to really look and see what's going on. And then we are able to let go of thoughts and memories which are just cluttering up our mind or just making us feel very kind of tired and weary and fed up, and reducing the amount of garbage in the mind means that it gives this sense of lightening up and expansiveness and space starts to appear in the mind. And then the various thoughts and habitual thoughts and ideas and views start to manifest in a different way. They start to be things you experience them as kind of bubbling up into the mind, and that sense of me thinking starts to fall away, and there is a sense of thinking arising. And then you begin to be able to evaluate this thinking again and to begin to notice things about it, particularly the kind of destructive or negative kinds of thought which we are so used to that we don't often recognize to what extent they hurt us or cause us pain. For instance, the let's say many people can have ideas. We all have ideas about ourselves, but these ideas become very fixed. And so some people have this idea of, I'm a bad person, you see. So, and that becomes a basic filter of experience. And so when you have that as a sort of a background filter of your experience, every time you do something foolish, say something foolish, you know, it's as if there I go again. You know, it's a proof. Look, I'm just such a horrible person. I'm such a failure. Every time something doesn't quite work out right, then it's a corroboration. It's a proof. Yes, there I go again. That's me. And of course, all the occasions when you do something successfully and you do something well, but don't really mean as much as, we don't give them the same kind of weight or significance, because that's not who I really am. You know, I'm really like this. That's kind of an exception. And of course, that kind of negative view of oneself can often come in very seductive form. Sometimes it can come in the form of humility. And so it's even more difficult to see through. But one of the values of this bringing the mind to the present moment is you start to uncover this kind of structure, the stories that you have, or what you call it, the narrative. You have a self-narrative. You have this kind of story about who you are in the world. And you begin to say, well, let's look at this story. You know, many of us, you know, we often think, surprise when we see other people's ideas of who we are not quite the same as our own idea of who we are. You know, well, who's right, who's wrong? You know, who's to, you know, you maybe had this kind of frustrating conversations with people where you say, I'm not like that. And they say, well, yes, you are. And they say, well, you're just repressing it. And you say, no, I'm not. Well, yeah, of course you'll say that. You know, if you're repressing it, of course you'll say you're not. You know, and you just go round and round in circles like that. But there is a standard when as the mind becomes calmer and clearer, sharper, then and there's no kind of fixed idea about who you are, then you'll be able to look at what goes on and what happens and particular ways of reacting and thinking about things in a lot more insightful way. And so begin to see certain kind of patterns emerging. If you feel like you're a failure, then you start to see, well, is that objectively backed up? You know, what are your standards? What are your criteria? And what are the goals you're setting yourself? If you're setting yourself too high goals, and then you're not realizing those goals, it may be not a matter of you're hopeless or you're not competent. It might mean that just you've set your sights too high, and this is, you know, very much a problem in present day society, isn't it? I mean, the statistics for depression, instances of depression are quite astounding, in that the, say, generation, say my mother's generation, parents' generation, my generation, so say someone, I was born in the late 50s, so someone born in late 50s compared with someone who was born in the 20s or the 30s has 10 times more likely to have a period of depression in their life. And these days, you know, saw recently statistics say like nursery 2 to 5 year olds in England, 1 in 10 is considered to be depressed. And you know, why is that? Why is there such a huge? I think it can be called an epidemic of depression in the modern world. And you know, for kids these days, there's just so much pressure on kids to develop and to be successful academically. That and there's some kids who feel that if they're not a success, their parents are going to be terribly disappointed, and they can't do everything that their parents want. So they start to feel they're a failure. And when they're a failure, why are they a failure? They're a failure because they're bad. And this idea that I'm bad is one of the most poisonous kinds of ideas that can appear in human mind. So we are bombarded by advertisements, by movies, by the media, and given almost incredibly high expectations of how we should live our lives, what kinds of material goods that we should have, incredibly high ideas of what kind of personality we should have, incredibly unrealistic ideas of the kind of satisfaction we should be having from sexual relationships, from so on. So all this is kind of not so often so overt, but it's just kind of there in the air, you know. You should be so much better than you are. You should be having so much more pleasure than you are. You're missing out, you know. So there's one of those, can't remember his name now, one of those kind of clever, cynical French philosophers that write aphorisms and letters and things. He said, being happy is not so difficult, but what's really difficult is being more happy, you know, than other people. And the reason it's so difficult is because we always assume that other people are more happy than they really are. So, and there's one of these interesting experiments where they asked all these, again, I can't remember the figures so much, but some idea. Let's suppose you had this situation where you're, I don't even know what wages are these days. Let's say you're getting £1,000 a month, and everybody else in the office is getting £700 a month. Okay, that's one choice. Or you can get a raise and you get £1,500 a month, but everyone else gets raised to £2,000. So which would you prefer? You have £1,000, everyone else has £700, or you have £1,500 and everyone else has £2,000. And I don't know whether what your opinion, but in this particular experiment, most people would prefer to have £1,000 than have more than everybody else. So, you know, again, this is you know, an interesting point about the world of the senses and material pleasures and so on, that it's not so much the thing itself as, you know, its meaning and the meaning it's given by society. In some cases, I can say this is not a materialistic society at all, far from it. Because if you were really materialist, you know, you'd buy something and you would be solely interested in the quality of that item. But in fact, people are willing to spend huge sums of money just to have a certain kind of label on a produce, which is actually not in the material sense, any superior to a generic product. But it's, I'm a person who has enough money, I have this status that I can, you know, have a Gucci handbag or whatever, you know. So it's more this, you want a particular kind of feeling, and it's a sense, it's bound up with a sense of who I am in the world, who I am in relation to other people in the world, rather than the direct physical experience of the object. So you know, I think it's a good argument to say this is not a very materialistic society at all. It's a matter of following certain kinds of feelings and perceptions. So this practice of developing awareness and clarity of mind is to be able to kind of turn the light within and begin to see this kind of whole structure of your particular world, the world you live in, your values. What is it that's most important to you in life? Making money and being successful and physically comfortable and so on, that's inevitable and nothing to be criticized, of course. But there still have to be certain kinds of prioritizing going on, isn't it? You know, to what extent do you put material wealth and a pursuit of wealth and success above quality time with your family, time to be by yourself, and so on? I mean, sometimes we have certain ideas, but then when you look at your life and actually what you do and how you actually live your life, maybe it's not quite in line with those ideals. And sometimes you can start off with very elevated ideals, but they gradually disappear. I mean, I often mention a poem that I read when I was still at school, and which affected me very strongly. And it's a poem by Gary Snyder, American poet, and talking about hitchhiking up Highway 1 in California and getting a lift on an alfalfa truck. And the driver of the truck says, I started off driving this truck up the coast when I was 18. And now I'm 60. When I started off driving this truck, I swore to myself that I wouldn't spend the rest of my life doing this. And do you know, that's exactly what I've gone and done. And I think that there's so many of us can have that kind of feeling. How did I get into this? This isn't really, you know, what I was planning to do with my life. But if you're not constantly coming back and grounding yourself and looking within very clearly and honestly, and just seeing, you know, what's going on here, then that's all too easy, because the pressures and the distractions are so strong that you need to be have a great deal of mental resilience and clarity and sincerity to be able to withstand that. So their practice of meditation is therefore one part of this education system that is laid down by the Buddha, and the ability to calm the mind and to dwell in the present moment for a sustained period of time is primarily in order to enable us to become a lot more intimate with and aware of what's really going on within ourselves. So there's so much going on under the surface, and so much of our behavior and of our experience in life is conditioned by values, thoughts, attachments, irrational, confused, conflicted kinds of emotions, that to entangle it all and really be able to deal with it successfully, you have to be able to be here now in the present. Otherwise, it's a matter of philosophy and theory, and it doesn't go very deep at all. So it's not to say that you know, you have this kind of project to become anybody special, but it's the interest to see what's this all about? What does it mean? You know, what's this body? What's this mind, thoughts, emotions? What's it all about? And as we look, clearly there are certain things that we start to notice most clearly of all, and that's that everything changes. And that's, you know, everything changes. What more cliche statement could be made? And yet it's the most profound of all possible statements if you're able to experience change in the present moment, not thinking about it, but experiencing it. Because so much of our whole sense of who we are in our life is based on non-awareness, lack awareness of change. Let's say, going back to this, being depressed. Now, when you're depressed, you're in the present moment, in a way, in a sense that all past experiences of happiness and any kind of fulfillment seem meaningless, seem so far away. And any possible improvement in the future seems meaningless. You know, just what here now seems, this is the way it's going to be forever. You see, there's no point in getting up out of bed, there's no point in doing this, why you can't be bothered, why, well, it wouldn't make any difference. So this sense of hopelessness and emptiness, because whatever you do, it's not going to change anything. This is based on a lack of clear awareness of the truth of change. You've probably heard about like learned helplessness. You know, if you want to mess somebody up, you put them in a situation where they are subject to unpredictable and painful experiences over which they have no control at all, and with no way that they can conceive of preventing that suffering from happening in the future or of it getting in any way better. I mean, this is the whole principle which in Guantanamo Bay, for instance, you know, they don't have any kind of prospect of being able to do anything about their situation. And then there's, as they say, if you have some kind of sense of predictability that there's going to be something really unpleasant going to happen tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock or every morning at 11 o'clock, you know, you can tense yourself and ready yourself. But when pain and discomfort and difficulty can arise without any kind of relationship to what you're doing, this is the sense of total helplessness. This is which is most undermining of mental health. And so the sense of lack of control is central to depression, the sense of things are always going to be like this, or perhaps if they change, get worse, things are never going to get any better, and there's nothing that I can do to do anything about it. Now, when you're practicing, you're meditating, you realize, in actual fact, that the state of pain or discomfort or depression or whatnot is not this kind of monolithic kind of mental kind of porridge. You know, it's great, I'm depressed or I'm upset or I'm someone who's grieving or whatever. But the more closely you look, the more you see the fluctuations of mood. Like if you look at, say, the sea from an aeroplane, you know, it can look completely flat. You go down much closer and you can see the waves. And so if you look at your mind a lot more closely than you're accustomed to, you begin to see fluctuations and changes, and you begin to see ways that you can affect that. And this applies to physical pain as well. Chronic physical pain is another major cause of depression. When you think there's no way this is ever going to get any better, it's going to be like this. But when you have this idea of pain, and particularly what makes it even worse, you've got my pain. You know, there's nothing which intensifies discomfort so much as the sense that it's me or it's mine. And that is something that you can do something about, the identification with pain. That more than anything else is a liberating force. But the pain itself, when you look at pain, you begin to notice it's not this kind of solid kind of area of pain, but the characteristic of pain itself can be fluctuating, whether it's a kind of a throbbing pain or a burning pain or different kinds of pain. The area, it's moving around. It's not just in one particular point. The intensity of the pain is not steady. So when you begin to see the location, the character, the intensity of pain as fluctuating and changing, then this idea that you've built, there's this thing called pain and is my pain, so you start to dismantle this. You see, well, is it really mine? What does it mean to say it's my pain? What does it mean to me? My suffering, my disappointment, my depression. You know, where does the my come from? You know, is it really necessary to posit this idea of an owner of it? So Buddha's saying, if you look really closely, you begin to see that this sense of me and mine and I is something that you're constructing moment by moment on top of what's actually there. And you don't have to do that. You can learn not to do that. Because it's not really part of your experience. It's just a habitual way you have of identifying with the different elements of the body and mind. So when you are able to let go of this ownership of physical, mental phenomena, then there's a sense of flow rising in the mind. And you don't have to sort of battle to control things and to, you know, it's got to be like this and so I can be comfortable and fear that, so, you know, it can change because there's not this you who's so fragile and has to be protected from things. There's this things arising and passing according to causes and conditions. And you begin to see that there are certain ways and certain areas in which you can exert an influence. So they say there's certain areas you can't. Okay, you're going to get old, whatever happens, you're going to get old, you're going to get sick, you're going to die. These are things that you have to be able to reflect on daily. And yes, I'm of the nature to get old, to sick, to die. Think about it a lot. And if you think about it in the right way, it's not depressing, quite the opposite. But if you think of it's me, you know, I'm going to get old, I'm going to get sick, I'm going to die, this poor old me, then that's taking hold of the subject in the wrong way. But when you see that sickness, old age and death is part of nature, and you partake of that just as everyone else does, then that side of things is dealt with acceptance. But the fear, the anxiety, the pushing away, the aversion, the hatred, all these things are extras which you add on, and you don't have to add on, and that's where this training takes place. So, start off by, as I say, establishing a firm foundation by bringing this awareness, kindness, empathy, compassion. To bear on the way that we live in the world, developing boundaries for ourselves and training, educating ourselves to be able to stay within those boundaries and turning the mind inwards and looking at what's actually going on, not who we think we are, what we'd like things to be like, but how they are right now and reflecting and learning from that. And gradually, they say, breaking down and undermining all these structures of delusion and mistaken ideas and thoughts and values that we've absorbed from from past lives or from our parents or from the culture, the society that we live in. It's not really necessary to go into that in too much detail, but right now, what's going on and what can we do about it? And as you put effort in, you begin to see, yes, you can make a real difference. And there is something that you can, there's always something you can do. There's always something that can be improved. And this sense of gradual enlightening, brightening, and clarification of mind is a sense of the Buddhist training. So I think I've spoken for long enough. And thank you for being very patient. And yes, thank you, because I these days I very rarely speak in English at all, let alone give discourses in English. So it's kind of a good exercise for me. So I'd like to open it up for questions now. It can be directly related to something I've just been talking about, or any kind of general questions or comments and about Buddhism in general, or anything at all, really. And so does anyone have anything they'd like to...